welcome to the Stanley Street Social Podcast presented by MAP. MAP have recently released a new training collection range, which you can find at map.cc. This range was designed with durability and comfort in mind, so it's perfect for those long days in the saddle. It's your best training partner. It'll be there from the first day of the season to the very last. So head over to map.cc and grab yourself some of this training kit. Following on from our Day with Cannondale podcast, which if you haven't checked it out, make sure you do, we headed to Spain to catch up with some of the EF Education First riders, and today's episode is with the Australian road captain, Simon Clark. We chatted to him about his superstar to 2019. We also discussed the changes that he's noticed in the 3 years that he's been with the team and how the team's gotten to where they are now. And we also chat about his future goals and his future races, which include the Tour de France this year, where EF will be riding the new Cannondale Super 6 Evo, which we talked about in our podcast with the Cannondale representative. So, really good episode with Simon, and we hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the Stanley Street Social Podcast. I'm here in Andorra today with EF Education First rider, Simon Clark. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us in your spot here in Andorra. It seems to be a bit of a hot spot for riders now. You were one of the pioneers, I heard, of coming to Andorra.
Yeah, I mean, not the pioneer, but one of the first... in the first group of guys that decided to make the move up here. And yeah, I've been here 6 years now, and it's really, you know, we love it. It's great. The support that the country gives the cyclists is really good as well. They're really behind us, and I've seen the roads evolve and the support that we've had to make it more cycling friendly, particularly for the pro cyclists that are coming to live here, is really significant, and it's really good to see.
Why do you think so many people are starting to move up here? Like, obviously there's a little bit of a benefit tax wise, a little bit of altitude as well, I guess.
Yeah, there's multiple reasons. Probably the biggest main reason is particularly for the Aussies, and the amount of Aussies that are now moving to Andorra, is we need to have a residency in Europe to be able to stay here more than 90 days, because nearly all of us only have Australian passports.
Yeah.
And that Andorra is one of the easiest places to get residency. And the problem is riding, you know, from me as an example, I ride for an American team. So the company I work for is technically American. And so what does a European country have interest in giving some dude a residency that works for an American company? You know,
yeah,
they have no interest in that. So it's not that easy to go up into any other country and just get residency to live there. It's not impossible, but Andorra is one of the places that have really welcomed pro cyclists and sporting athletes in general. And, you know, between that and the good training here, the mountains and whatnot, it's a perfect combination for pro cyclists.
And you've also got a spot in Italy as well. Your wife, she's Italian, so you kind of move between the two.
Yeah, we got a bit of a base there with my wife being Italian, so we get back and see the in-laws every now and again, and get back for a few good Italian meals.
Yeah.
But I mean, we love it here in Andorra. I mean, today's a perfect example.
It's unreal.
Of why we love it. It's just
looking over there, looks like it's like a 2D image. It's not real.
Sitting at 1500 meters on the terrace in a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Can't complain.
Let's talk a little bit about the team you joined, EF. I think it was probably Cannondale in 2016. What was it like moving from an Australian team to like an American team? I'm guessing there wasn't a whole lot of difference in terms of the culture, but what was different between the two teams?
I mean, there was a big difference in the culture, really. You know, Jerry Ryan's done a great job setting up Orica, and there's a really real family feeling in Mitchelton, and I think they've done a great job with that. And so moving to an American team, it was not that it's better or worse, just a different culture. They have, you know, Americans have a different way of going about things.
Yeah.
And they have their own style. But I was really looking forward to a change. I needed new challenges. I got to a stage in Orica where they kind of, the team didn't really see me progressing much further than I was already going, and so I needed to move to another team where they believed that I could continue to improve and deliver good results. And JV reached out to me and asked me if I'd be interested in coming over, and yeah, the answer was yes.
Yeah. What sort of goals did you have wanting to move? Like, what was the main focus, just to try and do your own thing in races a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, I've always, you know, I don't really have idols or anything like that, but I've always looked up to Simon Gerrans my whole career.
Yeah.
And he's like 6 years older than me, and so I've kind of always looked at what he's done 6 years before me and set that as like a goal. Not necessarily I have to do exactly what he's done, but if I can set the bar at that kind of level, then, you know, hopefully I can land there or somewhere in between.
Yeah.
And I felt like I got to a stage, you know, that flattened off a little. You know, I'd got some okay results. I'd won a few, you know, I'd won a stage in the Vuelta and the team's time trial and the Giro and worn the pink jersey, but kind of, I felt limited there, and I needed, you know, sometimes going to a new team, you feel like you need to prove yourself again.
Yeah.
And even just that in itself raises the bar. And actually the first race, my first race in Europe with Cannondale, I actually won in Italy in Lanciano.
Good way to start.
Yeah. I mean, is you're just so motivated to prove to them also that what they thought in you as a bike rider, they were right, and
yeah,
that this is, you know, I'm here to deliver. And so, yeah, I've been really enjoying it here. I really felt like I've found my little niche in this team. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that every rider finds their little spot in a team, and if you're competing with someone else for a particular spot, it's never going to work. And, you know, you really need to find a different team, and until you find a team that you have a little spot and a position, and the team believes in the qualities that you can bring to the team. Otherwise, you know, this sport's hard enough as it is. Yep. Without having that kind of support.
So what's your main role in the team now? Kind of like the road captain, the tactic man?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of initially fell into that kind of role because coming from Mitchelton or Orica back then, we had so much experience, and so we didn't really have road captains because everyone was pretty drilled and knew what they were doing. But then I got to Cannondale, and we had some really experienced guys, but we also had like half a team with really no experience, or guys that have been pro for years but they just hadn't learned anything and really needed guidance. And so that just came natural to me to pass on some of that experience that I gained in racing with Orica.
Yeah.
And I fell into this kind of role of leading the guys on the road, and I quite enjoy it. And it's important, you know, you really have to be able to communicate well, and communicate in a way that riders are willing to listen to you and do what you tell them. And that's not such an easy job, to be able to tell guys to work for someone else when they think they're the next whoever, and that they've got to work for their teammate. So there's particular ways of going about that and trying to keep your teammates on your side, but also actually tell them what to do. And there's a fine line there that you kind of need to play with. But then through the years, particularly Charlie Wagelius, the head director in this team, has really pushed me, has seen the qualities that I have as a bike rider, and he's really believed that I can personally deliver better results than what I was, because I was so caught up in this road captain job. And so he's really been pushing me to focus on my own performance the last couple of years, and it's been hard to switch back to that, because you go from thinking about all your teammates to thinking about yourself, and you kind of really have to be selfish and ride in a very, you know, kind of, I call it riding with your blinkers on, kind of like in horse racing.
Yeah.
You just got to ignore all the outside factors and just think of yourself. And you know, the level in the World Tour is so high that I find that's how you have to ride if you want to get any kind of personal result.
Be ruthless.
And, I mean, this year's kind of all clicked for me, and I've been able to flick that switch, and in the races that I've been given the green light, really deliver. So it's been going well this year.
Can you perform both roles? Can you be the team leader as well as the road captain? Is that a thing, or are the roles kind of separate?
Yeah, no, they are very separate, I find. Because as soon as you start thinking about the team situation, you stop thinking about your own situation.
Yeah.
And okay, maybe if you are that good a bike rider that you can afford to do both, but I'm not that. Mm-hmm. So I found that if I want to deliver at a race, I'd really need to ride for myself and ride selfishly, so to speak, and just think of purely on my own performance. And
yeah.
When I do that, you know, I've found this year that I really can perform with the best guys in the world, and it's really motivating.
We'll talk about the start of your season in a sec. What has been the main difference from when you joined the team in 2016 to now 2019? Because even last year, I think the first World Tour win you guys had was like in September, the Vuelta, possibly. Yeah. Now you guys won a lot of races, won obviously the Ronde, yourself, second at Amstel. Just looking at you guys on the TV, you're part of the race. You guys are like really, you know, involved compared to previous years. It's kind of been like where's EF? Like they're not really there. What's changed?
The biggest thing is EF, the sponsor. They were on board already last year, but in a less influential way, and then this year they've come on and basically taken over. So last year, as you would have seen, we had like four different team names and took about 3 minutes to pronounce it.
Yeah.
And this year, you know, we're just Team EF, and what they've brought on, you know, they've really taken us under their entire EF umbrella and part of the EF family, and it's kind of gets back to what I was talking about with the way Jerry Ryan set up Mitchelton, and we really feel like now we're part of a family and part of an, you know, there's 55,000 EF employees that probably at least half of them are watching a TV every time we race, cheering us on, and things like that go a long way when you know that there's people out there genuinely going for it, you know, supporting us, and that support, and obviously we've had a step up in the budget as well for the team, and that's really provided an opportunity for the team to invest in, you know, riders TT positionings and improving a few things in our equipment and technology that we're racing on, and I really think that those things have made a massive difference in performance.
You're talking a little bit about like the family feel. Do you think that that's probably something that lacks a little bit in cycling? Sponsors always seem to be these rich businessmen, just come inject money for a couple of years, then just pull the plug. So it's kind of hard to get a little bit of culture and morale built up.
Yeah, I definitely think that is, and I mean, until you've ridden in a team with that family feel, it's hard to say that it doesn't, that you don't need that.
Yeah.
But when you do, you know, suddenly it just raises the bar, and riders, you know, if you look at our team list from last year and this year, we're nearly all the same riders. Not that much has changed.
Yeah.
We're on the same bikes. We've changed, we had a few little equipment changes, but nothing significant. And suddenly we've gone from winning our first Pro Tour race in September at the Vuelta to being, you know, right up there.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's to do with that family feel that EF's brought on, and, you know, they've really got behind us. And even just from a management point of view, everything's run under the EF umbrella now, and we're just part of a 55,000 employee company. And obviously we're the sporting side of things, but there's a whole, you know, massive company behind us, and it gives you a lot of pride to race with the EF logo knowing that there's such a company behind you supporting you and so invested and interested, actually interested, and not just throwing money at something and wanting to see that publicity on the TV.
I think it's a really important thing to note. Bettiol winning the Ronde. Where were you? Where were you watching it? And what were you thinking when he was solo the last 15K? And then when he eventually won, what were your reactions?
Yeah, Bettiol was an interesting one because obviously I was teammates with him for 2 years when I first came. We both rode together for 2 years in 16 and 17. And then he just had a holiday at BMC,
for a year.
But that all happened because of the sponsorship issues in this team in 2017, and when we had a new sponsor coming on, and then they pulled out at the 11th hour, and at that moment he had an option to go to BMC, and went, you know, this team for a while there looked like it was going to shut down, and so obviously he had an option to leave and signed it straight away, and he did the right, you know, in that situation,
as you would.
He did the right thing, 100%. We all would have probably, because you know you get left without a team in October, late September, and
good luck.
You know, it can be career ending that, no matter how good a bike rider you are.
Yeah,
but yeah, and then he had a terrible year in BMC. Couldn't stay on his bike.
Yeah,
poor guy. And yeah, but we always, as soon as he left, I said, you'll be back, because I knew he'd be back. He loves this team, and it's funny. Quite often Italians need to be with other Italians to you know, they need friends around.
Yeah.
And he's just not one of them. He just loves.
He's an outlier.
Yeah. He still gets along with the Italians and obviously he's very close with them all, but he doesn't need them to perform.
Yeah.
Like he just loves his team. And so when he came back, I knew he was going to do well. And it's like I was saying about before, when you change teams, you really want to prove that, you know, they took a gamble taking you on in some way. And I want to prove that they made the right decision. And I knew that he would come back to this team going, you know, I'm sorry I left and I want to prove to you that I am, you know, you made the right decision to give me a second chance. And I know I've seen Bettiol, particularly in the 2017 Tour de France when Rigo came second. Bettiol was unbelievable.
Yeah.
He was riding front group on climbs, you know, down to like 30 guys in the Tour, and he's not really a climber. And I know the talent he has, but I just felt like he never committed 100%, and he was never ticking all the boxes.
Yeah.
And I always said to him, the day that you decide to commit 100%, you will win some big races. And I really saw that change this year. And, you know, he spent the whole of January in Tenerife sitting on top of the volcano preparing for the classics, and he's really come back to this team and gone, right, I'm going to do everything I can. And he's working very closely with the physios. He's had a few hip issues over the years which he's been able to resolve through the team physios, which has been great. And you know, once you start ticking all those boxes and you already have a big motor, you know, the sky's the limit.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't surprise me at all that he did that performance, but I was so happy that he did, obviously. But for a guy to win their first pro race to be Flanders...
It's ridiculous,
isn't
it?
Some people go, oh, that's amazing. And for me, I go, it makes me think how many races he could have won already before winning. Like, if you're good enough to win Flanders, you can win a lot of bike races on the pro circuit. And I just... You know, I'm stoked for him, and I just hope that this is the beginning, because he's a super talent and he can win some big races. Hopefully at the Tour. I know he's been back on Tenerife in this period now, and I'm sure he'll be firing again for the Tour de France. So I think we can expect some good performances,
some big things
from him there.
Yeah. Do you think that's all it takes, just to, like, obviously it's almost as big a win as possible, but you get that one and then you think, well, hang on, I can beat these guys anytime. Is that all it takes?
I mean, not all, but even for myself this year, being able to finish, you know, in the front in San Remo and line up with the guys for the sprint there, even though I was pretty toast, and then even going toe-to-toe with Van Avermaet in Strade Bianche, and then obviously the ride I had at Amstel, it's given me a lot of confidence and belief that, okay, I am good enough to ride in the front of these big bike races.
Yeah.
And instead of just riding with the mentality, okay, I've just got to try and be there and then we'll see what happens. Now it's like, okay, let's be there and then see how we're going
to
race the final, you know?
Yeah.
And that gives you a lot of confidence because you're not riding the whole day going, okay, I've got to make that split, got to make that split. It's like, I'm riding the day, so I'm in that split, and then I'm going to try and figure out how I'm going to win this race.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big mental step forward. And so once you can do a result, like Bettiol's done, definitely gives you a whole new level of confidence to what you're capable of, which is only super beneficial for the future.
Your start of the season's been pretty impressive. Top 10 in Torino, top 10 at Strade Bianche and San Remo, and obviously Amstel, which we'll talk about in a sec. But what's clicked? And, you know, top 10 in Torino, that's one of the hardest one-week stage races in the business. San Remo and Strade Bianche, two of the hardest one-dayers. What's clicked for you this year?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to note is they were all in Italy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I came to Italy when I was 16 as a first-year junior, and I've basically been in Europe ever since. But I did a lot of my early years racing in Italy. And so that's like, in terms of from a racing point of view, that's like my second home. Obviously living in Andorra, but we don't really ever race here apart from a stage in the Tour, in the Vuelta every now and again. Whereas in Italy, I really get on those roads, and I've raced so many of those roads. They kind of feel like semi-home roads to me.
Yeah.
I know those. You know, I've done Torino probably seven or eight times. I really know that race. And this year, for the first time since 2011, they didn't have a super long hilltop finish. So in 2011 was my first year in the Pro Tour with Astana, and I actually came 15th. I was like basically Neo Pro, and I was 15th overall in Torino. And they didn't have a long hilltop finish that day that year. And then I saw the course come out this year for Torino, and it was like 2011, and I'm like, okay,
punchy finishes,
here's my chance, I can ride GC here because the climbs are doable.
Yeah.
And I can I'm not going to be smashed on a 10k uphill finish by Quintana, and and so yeah, I went there, I was super G'd for it, and I was actually quite surprised starting the season in Provence. I came second in Tour of Provence, which I wasn't expecting. I didn't realise I was kind of going so well, to be honest. I'd just been at home. I hadn't raced. I didn't race in January at all. And just been at home preparing. And yeah, I came there and really found my legs and took it from there, basically.
Yeah.
And I obviously for the first year ever, I've skipped all of my Australian racing and just did a really slow progression build up during December and January into February. And I really think that was being able to control the whole of my January build up, I think, was really beneficial. And it kind of hurts to say because I do love racing the Australian summer,
yeah.
But how well I've been able to deliver early this year, I think I need to reflect a bit on how I achieved that and what my priorities are. Because I think being able to control, like in some ways, it's not hard enough, and in other ways it's too hard. And you know, you go really hard for an hour and then the rest is easy, and
yep.
You're only doing 4 hours a day, and sometimes you want to do more and sometimes you want to do less, and you can't, it's kind of out of control. Whereas when you're at home, you can really control exactly the quantity and quality that you're doing. And yeah, I mean, we seem like we got that right this year. And I've been, every year I come back and I'm like, right, if I'm going to get any better, I've got to step things up. And so I try and every year step things up 5%, you know, whether that's train harder or look at other areas where I can improve, get lighter or get stronger off the bike, in the gym or whatever it is, really try and, you know, if you're not moving forward, you're getting past. Yeah. So I really try and make that step up every year. And this year, things seem to really have clicked.
So do you think that that's the key, probably missing that Oz summer? Because Australians, they get caught up in it a little bit, don't they? They want to be flying in January. But if you're flying in January, it's hard to either come down and build again for spring or hold it. It's a real tricky one,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I know. And, I mean, it hurts me to say it because I love racing down under and love Cadell's race and even Sun Tour.
Yeah.
I've won Sun Tour and, you know, I'd love to get back there. But, yeah, like you said, you put it in the big picture and it's really, you kind of really got to reevaluate what's worth, you know, what's it worth to you.
Yeah.
And my problem is, I think if I could perform better in January, I'd have maybe a different opinion on it. But I, even doing all the prep that I can in December, I really struggle getting to top form for the first week of January. I just can't do it. And I'm always lacking that 5%. Uh-huh. And so the fact that I can't do it anyway, and then if I don't do it this year like I have, because we didn't touch on the reason why I didn't do the Australian summer this year, but I had a baby on the Friday of Tour Down Under. So we came back to Europe so we could have the baby.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the reason why I missed the Australian summer. And so I was at home babysitting and sleeping 5 hours a night, and you know, maybe that's another reason why I've been going well, you know, training when I'm not even training.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I've had quite a lot of changes this year, and it's hard to put my finger on one of them to say that was a decisive thing that's provided me with the chance to do these results. But I've reflected on a lot, and I've really tried to take note of what I've done this year, and I'm really trying to replicate that now in the lead up to the Tour de France and also for the future, future seasons.
So Amstel Gold Race, you were second behind New King, the new whiz kid. Was it a big target for you to start with, Amstel?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I really loved Amstel. I really like it, and I've always said that in general you need to do these classics 5 times before you can be competitive. And okay, there's exceptions to that rule. You get your Alaphilippes and these guys that just rock up, it doesn't matter what race it is, they kill you, or Van der Poels. But for most riders, if you see all of their big results in any classic, they've done them a whole bunch of times before they end up standing on the podium, whatever step that is. And this year I'd got to my 6th or something in Ardennes campaign, and I really felt like with the early spring form that I had, that this was my year to crack a good result. And so yeah, Amstel was a big goal for me. But you know, you can have big goals, but to deliver on races like that, there's just so many things.
It's on a one-day race.
Yeah, so many things that can happen. And you know, it's such a dangerous race, so much road furniture, so many corners and ups and downs, that so much can happen in 260K that, you know, you can perform, you can prepare all you want and be the biggest goal you want, but it can still, you know, with the form of your life, it can still go badly. So you just try and simplify things and really break it down and go, okay, I know I'm going good, but to go good, I need to get to the final. And so how am I going to do that? And I need to ride safely, basically, for 200K. and so that I deliver myself in a position where I can use my form to get a result. And obviously we had Bettiol as well, who just won Flanders, so I didn't go into Amstel as the outright leader either. And so that, depending on how Bettiol rode Amstel, that could have also been unfavourable to my aspirations, in the sense that if he was in a winning position, you know, I would obviously be taking a back seat and riding in his defence. And so I needed to also see how I was going to play my cards, so that we, you know, the goal is for the team to win the race, not to race your teammates. So I was also aware of that, and kind of had to go in, even though I was super G'd for the race, really going with an open mind and just try and see how I could put myself in a winning position.
Talk us through the last 10K, because on the TV it was Fuglsang, Alaphilippe, one of those two were going to win it. No one else could win it. I think the gap was like a minute. What was it like, that last 10K? And especially that last 500, you got on Van der Poel. You probably knew he was the quickest guy there. You're a smart bloke on the bike, Simon. Everyone knows that. You've obviously picked the right wheel and paid off in the end. Couldn't quite get around him. But
yeah,
talk us through that, last 5-10K, because it was ridiculous.
Yeah, the fact that he won the Mountain Bike World Cup on the weekend and just beat Nino Scherter, it doesn't make me feel quite so bad that I didn't get around him in Amstel, considering he just pumped one of the best mountain bikers ever.
Dusted him up.
But yeah, so it was actually a super emotional roller coaster for me as well, in that last 10K, because there I was with Mollema chopping off as hard as we could for that, probably it was like 15K really, and we just couldn't get any closer to the guys in front of us. And so here I am thinking, oh, I'm sixth and seventh on the road, you know, maybe if we catch the guy in front, I can get a top five. And so I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to, you know, I've got a top five-ish in me. And okay, that's a great, you know, in Amstel, I would be happy with that. I hadn't even been in the top 10 before. So I wasn't, you know, I was G'd, but, you know, it was like, okay, let's go for that. And then I started getting this information on the radio that Van der Poel was coming. And then
he was coming from the back, was he?
Yeah. So there was a group of, like, the group that I went away with, which was, I don't know, there was 20 of us left. He came across with four other guys and caught us with 3K to go. And then I'm like, oh, shit, I'm not even going to run in the top 10 now. Like, four guys have just caught me. If I don't play my cards right, I'm not even going to run a top 10. And kind of, if you're not in the top 10, it's
nothing,
a bit
really
of a nothing,
yeah,
nothing result. And so then I'm like, all right, well, I better bloody play my cards right here. And then they've caught us, and he's just gassed it up that last drag coming into 2K to go. And we caught Shackman and Trentin. And then suddenly we come around the corner and we can see Kwiatkowski and Alaphilippe and Fuglsang right there. And I'm like, shit, we're sprinting to win here. So then I've gone from thinking, oh, maybe top five, to then, oh, I'm not even top 10. And then suddenly we're like, here we are, we're on here.
Yeah.
And so as soon as Van der Poel caught me, I knew he was the guy. And I took a quick look around at who I was with, and the only real other fast guy I was worried about was Shackman, who'd been going really well in Pays Basque the week before and won a bunch of stages. And so I just got straight on Van der Poel, and I knew that he was the guy to be on. And we're there at 800 to go, and he's leading us out, and I'm on his wheel, and I'm thinking,
beauty.
Here we go. Like, okay, we haven't caught him yet. Like, if it wasn't for his sprint, it was touch and go whether we were going to catch him. And I'm like, if I'm ever going to come off Van der Poel, it's after he's led me out for 800 metres.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I just lined up and he hit out. And, you know, one thing that Gero kind of, he didn't consciously teach me, but I learned off Gero is, He was really good at his first sprint being at 200 to go, even after 260K. He hadn't done a sprint all day. And that's one thing I really keep in my mind when I'm racing for myself, is that I don't do a sprint all day over 1,000 watts until that last one.
Yeah, okay.
And I was coming to that finish going, all right, we're on here, and I haven't done a sprint yet. That was, you know when you roll out of your house when you go training, and that first sprint you do is like, they're your best watts. Uh-huh. And if you can do, you know, obviously we train a lot and are capable of doing those kind of distances, but if you can not do that one sprint, all-out sprint, even after 250K, you can still do a super sprint if you haven't tapped into those resources mm-hmm. all day. And I hadn't. So I'm like, right, I've got a good sprint here. Whereas using it as an example, in San Remo, I went over the top of the Poggio 12 seconds behind the front guys, and I did a standing sprint out of every single U-turn down the Poggio to get back on.
Risk your life on the downhill as well.
Yeah, I mean, me and Moritz got close to breaking the Strava on the Poggio descent. And, okay, I didn't have a choice, because if I didn't do that, I wasn't getting back on.
Exactly.
And back into the front. But I burnt my bickies, and then I got to the sprint, and I was, you know, I left it on the descent, basically.
Yeah.
But I knew, I'm like, I'm lining up in Ansel going, I haven't done that sprint yet. And so I line up on Vanderpoel, and he's hit out, and he's lined up the 3 litres perfectly, got the hit off them. And I mean, I did the best sprint I could have done, and the guy's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I didn't really get close to him. But yeah, I mean, I'm super happy that even to run second to a guy like this, you know, the fact that he's just gone to mountain bike and cleaning up there and World Cups as well, you know, proves that this guy is just unbelievable.
On another level.
You know, I'm still happy to have finished second to a guy like that.
Yeah.
And plus, with this such a spectacular finish that came out in the end, you know, I think it's cool to be a part of an Amstel that we talked about for a long time.
People just saying it's like the best finish of a bike race of all time.
Yeah.
It must be pretty cool to be involved
in
something so wild like that. That's what I heard. That's what I was reading.
I don't know about all time, but in terms of classics and all, there's not many classics that have come down to a finish like that.
Yeah.
But in my time, I'm sure if you went back far enough, you'd find one. But it was pretty exciting. So I mean, it all just clicked for me. I mean, you can have the form of your life, like I said, and things not work out, and you need to have the form of your life and a bit of luck on your side.
Yeah.
And everything just seemed to click for me that day.
So now we're up here in Andorra. So after a big spring like that, you kind of just cool off a little bit and then prepare for your next major goal, which is the Tour de France with EF. You'll be there with Rigo, will probably be the main man, doing Dauphiné before that, is that correct?
Yeah.
And then the Tour.
I've done a pretty similar program the last bunch of years now, and I think there's not enough said about riders finding what program works for them and then just repeating it year after year.
Yeah.
And then that way you can fine-tune things, and, you know, even this year, you know, I do Torino every year, I do San Remo every year, I do Pays Basque every year, I do the Classics every year, and then after the Classics I have a week break every year, and then I have 4 weeks prep until the Dauphiné. And you do that enough times, and with trial and error you figure out what works and mm-hmm. what doesn't. Whereas if every season you're doing different races and get thrown in different stuff, it's hard to fine-tune that preparation. And so I really appreciate the support from the team to continue to give me a consistent program that I can work with, and that way I can fine-tune what I do at home, learning year after year of what I need to be doing to perform as best as possible. And I see a lot of guys that are always chopping and changing programs, and I think that it's really hard to nail down what works and doesn't work for you if you're doing something different every time you rock up. So yeah, like most of the years now, I had a week off after the Classics, and I've got a 4 week block now, a pretty intense training block leading into the Dauphiné, which we're 10 days out now, and then 3 more weeks at home after the Dolphinade to fine-tune things before the Tour.
So it's all about Rigo, you think, at the Tour de France for you guys? He's been second there before. He's back in Colombia now, fine-tuning.
Yeah, Rigo's definitely our GC hope. We've also got Danny Martinez, who's still qualifies for the Young Riders jersey, the white jersey. And so a kind of second goal, I believe, is for Danny to chase the white jersey, because he's another super talent coming out of Colombia, and I really think that he'd be knocking on the door to go with that, to win that jersey. So
flying
between Rigo chasing the yellow jersey and Danny Martinez chasing the white jersey, I reckon we'll have our work cut out for the month of July.
And for yourself, do you retake on that role as road captain, or will you get your own chances on a few stages?
I'll definitely have to slot back into that road captain role for a good part of the tour.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I love doing it, particularly with Rigo. We get along so well, and we've had great success doing that, particularly in 2017. But yeah, hopefully I'll maybe get a few opportunities to jump up the road and have a bit of fun. Mm-hmm. But obviously we just need to see how things go. Priorities, you know, the team getting a great GC result, and everything, work everything out backwards from there.
So what about the actual future, looking past this year for the team, EF? You've got a few young riders, Whelan, Martinez, like you said, Hugh Carthy, who's been doing some good bits and pieces in the Giro. Is that kind of where you think the growth is going to come from in this team, this young crop that you've got, and guys like yourself kind of mentoring these young guys through?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there. It's, you know, we see with Hugh Carthy, he was already pro with Caharual for a couple of years, and then he's done, how many, is it 2 years now, or three, maybe even 3 years in this team. And so you need a bunch, you know, unless you're an absolute freak, you need a bunch of years to develop. And so it's hard to just sign a young guy. And, you know, even Whelan, I think, is a super talent, and he's doing great this year for his first year. But, you know, I'd be surprised if it doesn't take him another 3 years before he's doing anything like Hugh's doing this year at the Giro.
He was a rider that, as an under-23, he had a couple of races in Europe. Like, he's just been thrown straight into it.
And if you take that into account, he's doing amazingly well. Like, for guys that I've seen with a lot more European experience and struggle so much more in the pro peloton, Jimmy Whelan's a really interesting, an interesting signing, and he's doing really well, and I really hope he continues on his current trajectory, because I think he'll be a really good rider in the future if he can continue to go the way he's going. You know, it's not easy moving over here. He hasn't spent a lot of time in Europe. A lot of people at home don't realize the social factors behind being a pro cyclist and living in Europe. And you know, anyone can go good living at home with their mum cooking and washing and cleaning for them, and all they do is eat, sleep and train and lie on the couch all day.
Yeah.
And suddenly you move to Europe and you got to do all that yourself, and then you got to ride better than what you were doing with your mum's cooking. And a lot of people don't realise that, and there's a lot in that. And I think that I would go as far as saying probably 80% of the guys that maybe turned pro or came to Europe and didn't make it, or they were pro for a little bit and then they never settled in Europe, and they never made Europe home.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can make Europe home, I think you're halfway there to be a 100%. Pro cyclist, because that's just key. You've got to be able to stay here all year and feel like you're just doing your job and living out of home. Because if, you know, this sport's hard enough if you're not relaxed at home and doing everything right there.
Yeah.
And so I've spoken to Jimmy a lot about that, and I really hope that, you know, he's already doing well, but it's really got to come from the rider himself to want to make it home and to want to do everything right. You can't have someone there telling you what to do. It's got to come from them, otherwise it's never going to work. So I think watch that space, because I think he's going well. He's in Dolphino, so...
Yeah, we caught up with him a couple of days ago.
Yeah, he's in for a shock there. Dolphino's...
Good way to learn.
Hardest race bar none in the world. And being the Tour de France selection race.
Yeah.
And if you can get through the Dolphino and not cop hiding... Well, you cop a hiding. Even I cop a hiding in the Dolphino. But if you can get through the Dolphino and still have a little bit of morale left, then you're gonna be an all right bike rider, because it doesn't get any harder than that.
So what can you do, like, as a senior rider at races like that, if a youngster's just getting absolutely thrashed? What can you do to kind of keep morale up and, you know, keep him just chipping away?
Yeah, I mean, I just try to break it. You know, you just got to simplify things, because it's pretty daunting when, you know, maybe Sky's on the front and you haven't gone under 50k an hour for 100k and you're just copping a hiding and you haven't even gone over a hill and you're already basically nearly getting dropped and you got two cat ones to go first. And it's like, you just need to simplify things down and go, right, okay, I just need to get to the bottom of this climb and I know I'm climbing good. And then I'll just find my group and they'll get me to the finish or whatever it is. Just, you know, you got to stay positive and really set small goals, easy goals, even if it's just getting over the second last climb. You know, once you've made it over that, get to the bottom of the last climb, check out, and you're cruising the finish. You're not going to miss time card or anything like that. And so instead of going, oh, there's still 100K to go and I'm bloody stuffed and Sky just handing it to me, if you think, okay, well, the top of the second last climb is only 40K away, and then if I get over that, well, I got 23K of descent and another 20K of flat, and then we hit the last climb and then I can check out and I just cruise to the finish, you know. Uh-huh. And if you break it down like that, well, it's not really 100K to go, it's only 40K to go.
Yeah.
Take a bunch of gels and
get through it.
Yeah. Throw your bins at the bottom of the second last climb and go, right, I just got to get to the top. And so you simplify things like that and you really can make life, you know, mentally, it's a big mental game. It's particularly, you know, at this level when things are just so hard, if you're not mentally on game, you know, it's pretty hard.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a similar thing happened with last year in the Tour when Lawson crashed and broke his shoulder and got back up and he's riding and you know, he was all obviously like down on morale and really, you know, nearly in tears. And I basically just went back to him and said, look, you just got to break this down. There's 60K to go. We got 40K of dead straight block headwind. You're not going to get dropped in with the bunch riding into a headwind. We turn left. There's 20K of sidewind, and you know, Froomey's crashing and Bernal's crashing and everyone, Yates is crashing. And I just said, get to that left-hand turn, 20K to go. You only got 40K of block headwind, and then you can ride as slow as you want for 20K. You're still making time cut. So don't worry about how much you're hurting. Just count those 40K down. You're not going to get dropped with the bunch riding into a headwind. Then, you know, they'd have to do 80K an hour, and you'll be fine. And, you know, if you simplify things down like that, okay, that's not the right mentality if you're trying to win bike races, but when you're just trying to get to the finish and survive certain stages, you know, using that kind of mentality can really help get you through.
Last question before we let you go. National championships. Is it something that you want to tick off, or is it, you know, we were talking a little bit before that something you might have to sacrifice, but it'd be pretty cool having those green and gold stripes for a season, and it's a parkour that does suit you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I dream of being able to wear the Aussie jersey in Europe, and I think any pro would be lying if they told you they didn't. It's just unfortunate that the timing of it. Mm-hmm. And I've been really trying to campaign for them to somehow consider putting road nationals after Tour Down Under, just to give the pro tour riders some time to build up the off season, build up from the off season, have a race, because you get these, you know, the level is getting so good in Australia now, and these guys, they train all year and that's their peak race.
Yeah.
And they're good riders. Like Freeberg's an awesome rider.
Chris Harper is the same.
They if that's their number one goal for the year and we're in pre-season mode, you know, of course they're going to be competitive.
Yeah.
And I don't take anything away from his win. What he rode did this year was amazing. I watched it on, I streamed it on from over here. But I really feel like, you know, the national jersey, if you look back to the years that Stewie had the jersey and Robbie had the jersey and they'd take it to Europe and it was in the tour every year, you know, that was, I think that's the way it should be. And back in the, I know that nationals has always been then, but back in those days, the level in Australia wasn't as good.
Yeah.
So these, the Euro pros could come back in January on 70, 80% form and still take the jersey and take it to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that anymore. And if Cycling Australia is happy for a continental rider to have the national jersey every year, then leave it the way it is. But if they do want to have the Australian national jersey in the Grand Tours and in the Tour de France, I think maybe they need to consider moving nationals.
Yeah.
And that's my opinion. I mean, I'm sure there's a bunch of people out there that maybe don't agree with my opinion. But I really feel like, you know, imagine if Cadell's race was nationals and all the World Tour guys, like even Richie has a week racing in his legs, like we'd be up a hell of a race.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, it's our first hit out, none of us even know how we're going. Every year we all cramp because we just haven't strained our muscles like that.
45 degrees.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and it's just, although I don't take, you know, the last, every guy that's won it the last bunch of years deserves it, every cent of it. I think that maybe it's worth reevaluating, you know, how they want the, you know, if they're happy with the way it is or whether, not that I feel like we don't have a chance to win, because of course, you know, I could not have an off season and start training in November, and sure, I could be peaking for January, but
don't worry about spring then.
Yeah, but my team, you know, I don't get paid to do that, and I could win nationals, but that's not going to get me a pro contract.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, justify my wage with my pro team that pays me in winning a race that I'm not even wearing, that I, you know, they don't really, I'm a participate as an individual, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's hard to justify for us. Whereas if it was maybe just moved to after Down Under or after Sun Tour, like suddenly, I think we'd have much more exciting race too. With a lot of more of the pro tour guys. And I think a lot of guys are not doing it these days because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's less and less guys are coming back out for it. And I think that if they moved it, you know, a little bit later in January after a bit of racing that we could have, you'd get a lot more guys doing it.
Yeah.
And you'd see a cool race. So yeah, it's something to think about, and who knows? See what happens. You know, maybe they can run Cadell's race is the weekend after, and they've just announced this Thursday race with the around Torquay. You know,
flicked the Albert and Park race.
Yeah. So you know, why couldn't we have, you know, the nationals on the Thursday or something? The elite men, and then have, I don't know, the women on the weekend. And then the World Tour race for the men on the Sunday.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a way of working it in there where, you know, you could easily ride the nationals on the Thursday and ride the pro race on the Sunday. And yeah, I think it would be really interesting to do something like that. But obviously there's a whole bunch of factors that goes into race organisation and sponsorship and funding and all that kind of thing. So, you know, that's obviously the rider's opinion, and there's a whole lot of politics and logistics that goes into producing any kind of race. But yeah, I think that maybe a little calendar shuffle could be interesting for nationals. But yeah, like I said, definitely love to wear the the jersey, but I've tried a bunch of years to really be good at nationals, and I'm finding it's just too early.
Yeah.
I just can't do it without necessarily stopping a month earlier in Europe and starting the whole season a month earlier.
Yeah.
And yeah, so we'll see. I'm a bit put off it at the moment, like, just because of the sacrifice that it takes. The level is just, basically, it's the level of nationals is just getting so high now, and it's great to see. Don't get me wrong, I'm stoked to see that there's so much more depth now in Australian cycling. But yeah, it's harder for the European pro to justify going back and doing it when it's, you know, it's like going, okay, you do the tour, but you can't do the Dauphiné, and you just got to. You can't race in May or June, and you just got to rock up as good as you can.
Yeah.
But everyone else can prepare perfectly, and then you just got to do as best you can. And it's kind of, it puts you off when you can't, you know, I don't want to rock up to nationals at 80%. And, you know, I want to be the best I can be, and I just can't do it the way it is set up at the moment. So we'll see. We'll see.
We have to get the king of Ballarat, Pat Shorter, pull a few strings to change the date.
Yeah, I know. It's just the hardest bit to change it would be logistically. You know, before Cadell's race started, I think they could have easily whacked it on the Cadell race weekend. But now Cadell race is there, and then Sun Tour's straight after it. It's like,
it's a super full calendar.
Do you have it the week after Sun Tour now?
Yeah.
But then it's like, it's going to be hard to keep guys in Australia because you're starting to tap into what's early European season then.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, that's something for them to work out. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe they can push Sun Tour back a week, or I don't know what they do. Make Cadell's race nationals. But, you know, I know there's a close link with Ballarat there, so, you know, they'll work it out. But I think I've said it to a few, I've mentioned this idea to a few influential people in Cycling Australia, so we'll see
what happens.
See if I can get any traction.
Maybe post career you can move into that sort of space.
Oh, I don't
event
know.
Management and logistics.
No, I just really want to wear it.
Yeah, so, no doubt.
We'll see.
Simon, thanks very much for having us at your place here in Andorra and joining us on the podcast and sharing all your fantastic stories with us.
No worries. Thanks very much for having me, and hello to everyone back in Australia. And thanks for all your support. It's much appreciated.
Thanks for listening.